So, Majjhima 47, the Vimamsaka Sutta, an invitation by the Buddha to his monks to thoroughly examine him in order to find out if his claim to being an awake monk was true and genuine. Notice that it's an invitation to investigate the Tathagata, it's obviously not meant to be applied generally to anybody. And elsewhere, of course, the Buddha encouraged blind faith and obedience. In many places, we've seen that in the suttas. Perhaps. It's just a matter of interpretation, even.
Is that the Kalama Sutta, Bhante? The Kalama Sutta, does it say
that? It was something along, something in that, yeah, something.
Was there an A in front of that particular Pali word?
There may have been, but let's just not worry about details. Okay, so this one is, has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama 186. Similar title, Seeking Understanding, and while the Pali version takes place in Jetta's Grove near Savatthi, the Chinese version is in Kamasadhamma in the Kuru country, where of course the Mahanidana Sutta and the Satipatthana Sutta and other suttas were taught. So which setting is more likely to be pertinent, and according to which principle? The Savatthi Normalization Reduction Principle, which holds that
if it's in Savatthi, which is the normal place of origin, then the one that gives an odd reading is probably more likely to be true.
Okay, very good. So that's a variation of the Lekito Difficultor something, which we learned about some of the time, the Latin thing. Yeah, that one. In future, when I have to quote Latin, I'll just move my mouth and you can actually say it now. And that's good. So in other words, that texts tend to be normalized by editors who sort of make them normal. And so the abnormal bits are often likely to be more plausible. Okay.
So the Buddha's really
far west. Yeah, near Delhi, modern day Delhi. Same area, Kuru country. Okay. Last time I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove and Atapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus! Bhante, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is an inquirer, not knowing how to gauge another mind. Okay, Bhikkhu Bodhi's rendering here, should make an investigation of the Tathagata in order to find out whether or not he is fully enlightened. Okay, so an inquirer, here we have the vimamsakena. Okay, so the inquiry is vimamsa. Okay, as we found in the four idipadas. Okay, the fourth of the four idipadas, vimamsa, inquiry. This is I believe, if I'm not mistaken, a desiderative reduplication from the root man, meaning mind. So meaning something like think. That's a very crude way of putting it, but you get the idea. It's doubled up, think. Vimamsaka, and ena is the instrumental ending, so by an inquirer, okay, by a bhikkhu who is an inquirer. Parasacchetu pariyayang ajanatev, not knowing how to gauge another's mind. You see, in English we say to read another's mind, yeah? Which is actually quite revealing as to the nature of what we think mind is. We think mind is like a book. That is, we think it's comprised of words which are arranged in sentences, and so we read it, yeah? But of course, actually, the mind's much more complicated than that. That's only a part of what the mind is. And when you look at how this mind reading as such is described in the sutta. Sometimes it's true, it's described in terms of knowing another person's thoughts, their vitakas, but more often than not, it's described in terms of knowing the emotional state of their mind, whether they have greed, hatred, delusion or not, and these kinds of things. So, pariyaya is like the ways, almost like the ways, or the pariyaya is like a way around, literally a way around. So of another, parasa, of another, okay, this is a genitive form, parasa, of another, jeto pariyaya, knowing the way around another's mind. And jeto tends to have the implication of heart rather than mind. So it tends to be, for example, in the four Brahma Viharas, it's called a jeto vimuti. Yeah? So it tends to be an emotional thing. It's not a hard and fast distinction, but tends to be an emotional thing. So knowing the ways of another heart, of another's heart, or another's mind. Okay.
And manas or
mind? Manas is mind. Where are you looking at manas? Oh, manas. Yeah, manas is mind. Yeah, usually mano in Pali. And the declined forms, it's one of those things because it's a consonant declension. And the declined forms often have the manas root, like manasa or something like that. But the nominative form and the compound form is mano. Okay? Should make an investigation. Okay? Alright, the tathagata is a locative singular. Okay? Here meaning about, regarding. Okay? Samannesana kataba. And this is the inquiry or an investigation. Samannesana. Esana meaning search, and saman, I think this is from the root mind again, not 100% sure of that. So, searching the mind, something like that. It's another very common word. There's many words in Pali that have that similar meaning of vimangsa, samanesa, or vichaya, and so on, meaning inquiry or investigation, kataba. Okay? Okay, so this is what they should investigate to find out if he is fully enlightened or not. Samma sambuddho, the rightly enlightened. Wa no wa. Wa meaning?
Or.
Oh, very good, thank you. Wa, and this being a?
Indeclinable.
Indeclinable. And furthermore, being an?
Feminine indeclinable.
Yeah, you can't have a feminine indeclinable. Enclitic particle. Mm-hmm. No, and no meaning?
No.
No,
no, very good. Is Buddha enlightened or not? Iti, thus, vijnanaya, to know, in order to know, vijnanaya. Okay?
In order to know?
Yeah, something like that.
What form is it?
Let me just double check that, whether or not he is fully enlightened. In order to know, I was taking it as a dative vijnanaya, yeah, with an iti on the end. Bhagavan Mulaka. So our teachings, our dhammas, are rooted in the Blessed One. Mulaka, Bhagavan Mulaka, Mula being the root. Bhagavan Netika, guided by the Blessed One. So the Blessed One is the Netika, who's the guide. And this root, N-E, the root actually is disguised in here as the N-E. It's the same root we find in Vinaya. Okay? So E can also be spelled A-Y-A in Pali. So Vinaya is the same as Ne. And the leading out, Bhagavan Pati Sarana, and of course Sarana being the three Saranas, three refuges. Okay? It would be good. Sadhu Vatabhante. If the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words, having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Okay? And the word to remember here, dhare santiti, to bear in mind. Okay? To dharana, it's bearing in mind. And it's used as a synonym for sati, mindfulness. Dhare santi. This is a future tense plural verb. The bhikkhus will remember. Then listen, bhikkhus, and attend closely to what I shall say. Okay? Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied, the Blessed One said this. Okay, bhikkhus and inquire, not knowing how to gauge another's mind. Okay, so obviously the point here, meaning that if you have the psychic ability to know somebody else's mind, then you don't have to bother with this stuff. You just go straight ahead. Read the mind. Should investigate the Tathagata with respect to two kinds of states cognizable through the eye and through the ear, thus, okay, dvisu dhammesu, so with regard to, okay, again, the locative case in sense of with regard to or about two dhammas, okay, this is locative plural, alright, same as we saw here, the locative case with Tathagata, is meaning about inquiring regarding or about the Dhamma. Here, inquiring about two Dhammas. Okay? So two kinds of state Dhammas. Dhammas cognizable through the eye and through the ear. Thus, okay? Chakku sota vinyeyesu dhammesu. Okay? Regarding through the eye, ear, through the eye, chakku, and the ear, sota. Vinyeya is derived from vinyana, what's knowable, okay? Cognizable. Are there found in the Tathagata or not any defiled states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? Sankilipta, say defiled. So this is the past participle from the words kilesa, which we know usually quite familiar with in Buddhism. But in the suttas, rarely is the word kilesa found by itself. Mostly it's sankilesa, as in this form here. It's past participle form, sankilipta, defiled dhammas. Are they known or not? And again, the va, no va form here, a little bit more disguised, but the same construction we had here, va, no va, are they found or not? Okay, and here the same thing, va, no va, ti, being the end of the question. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's note here, bodily actions are dhammas cognizable through the eye, and words are dhammas cognizable through the ear. And the commentary says, just as one infers the presence of fish from the rippling and bubbling of water, so from a defiled action or utterance, one infers that the mind originating it is defiled. Okay? So, we've been talking about this a little bit from time to time, and this knowledge of inferential, this notion of inferential knowledge. In fact, we talked a little bit about that last night. So this is one of the, this is a kind of contrast which is making here. We talked about the two ways of knowing. One of them is direct knowing and one inferential knowing. And so what this sutta is saying, well, if you can't know it directly, i.e. by and scanning and knowing somebody's mind, then you learn by inference, okay? And that you infer from their actions, speech or bodily actions, to what you think their mind is. So obviously, a bit uncertain, isn't it? Yeah, there's a degree of uncertainty there. It's not always possible to know what a person's mind is from their actions or their speech.
I would have said, mindfulness when you know somebody, a person who's judging their interpretation of another person.
Uh-huh. You know the judger rather than the judged.
Yeah.
But aren't you making that, aren't you the judger of that person? Yeah, the person, if you say you know that judger, there's like a triangle, isn't it?
Oh, that person is just really evil, you know, like every time I see them, it's really evil.
Mm.
You know, it's really, like, very often a comment about me and the way I see things.
Right. Sure, can be.
Whatever they do, it just doesn't irritate me, probably because I don't like it about myself.
Yeah. I mean that's true, but I don't think it doesn't. I don't think it's any more true of this area than anything else. You know, it's the same with you know, all kinds of interpretation and judgment that you're always putting your own interpretation. Of course, that's a problem, isn't it? Because you think some people think things are defiled. Like if you're in the Thai forest tradition, you know, the Ajahn sitting there smoking away, and nobody thinks that that involves any defiled dhammas. But if you come from Western perspective, you see somebody smoking, you think, oh my God, how can they do that? So, when one investigates, he comes to know there's no visible or audible dhammas which are found. Okay. Next, when he comes to know this, he investigates them further. Are there to be found in the Tathagata or not any mixed states cognizable through the eye or through the ear? Okay, so mixed states, according to the commentary, the sub-commentary, refers to the conduct of one who's engaging in purifying his conduct but is unable to keep to it consistently. Sometimes his conduct is pure or bright, sometimes impure or dark. Whether that seems more like it's... Is that right? Is it saying, when it says mixed dhammas, does that mean sometimes good and sometimes bad, or does that mean that the act itself is a mixture of good and bad? Yeah? Yeah, neither black nor white, or mixed black and white, which is very common, isn't it? Sometimes we like to argue for things maybe that in themselves are good, but maybe we're coming from a sense of selfishness or self or whatever, that also tends to defile or corrupt those things as well. When he investigates them, he comes to know no mixed states cognizable through Arya are found in the Tathagata. Okay? So it's a matter of keeping on investigating. So notice this thing of not coming to a quick conclusion. Okay? And also notice that it's based on what's knowable. Okay? So it says sangvijjanti. It's not saying that they, you know, whether they exist or not. Okay? But whether they're knowable or not. Okay? So it remains limited. All you can do is say, well, I can't see anything, I can't hear anything that makes me think that there's anything defiled. Okay? But you can't therefore quickly rush to the conclusion that there are or are not defilements, but you need to keep on investigating. So are there any cleansed states? Vodata. So here vodata, cleansed, purified, and opposite to sankilipta. Okay, vodata, cognizable through the eye or ear. When investigating comes to know, cleansed states cognizable through the eye or the ear are found in the Tathagata. When he comes to know this, he investigates him further. Has the venerable one attained this Dhamma over a long time, or did he attain it recently? Okay, here is an interesting kind of idea. Is there's like a consistency of conduct over a long period of time. The explanation for this, for bhikkhus, as long as a bhikkhu has not acquired renown and attained fame, the dangers connected with renown and fame are not found in him. But when he has acquired renown and attained fame, those dangers are found in him. Again, according to the commentary, the dangers are conceit, arrogance, etc. For some bhikkhus, as long as they have not become well known or acquired a following, these dangers are not found, and they are very calm and quiet. But then they become famous and acquired a following, they go about behaving improperly, attacking other bhikkhus like a leopard pouncing on a herd of deer. I mean, as Venerable said, Yantra is a sort of a great example in the modern time of a monk who seems to have been undone by his inordinate fame. I'm sure there's many lesser examples as well.
What about the head of the Dharmakaya group?
Well, in certain cases you wonder whether there's an undoing or whether it was simply undone from the beginning.
There's one of those areas started off well,
yeah,
but then the fame and the money.
Yeah.
Could some of it be stories that arise around a famous person?
Mm-hmm. Could some of it be stories? Of course that some of it's stories, yeah, but usually
there's a basis.
Well, it depends on the case, you know. In some cases maybe there isn't, but in some cases there is.
You have to use your discrimination.
This is why you have to use the discrimination, your inquiry. Yeah.
They had stories about the Buddha, didn't they?
Yeah. Okay, in the Madhyama Agama version, slightly different on this point, instead of saying whether they've attained the Dhamma recently, it talks about whether it's practiced the Dhamma recently, or over a long time, or only temporarily. Whether there's any meaningful difference or not is a bit difficult to say. Only a minor difference there. Okay. Next one. Is this Venerable One restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and does he avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because he was without lust through the destruction of lust? When he investigates in him, he comes to know this Venerable One is restrained without fear, not restrained by fear, and he avoids indulging in sensual pleasure because he is without lust through the destruction of lust. So it seems a bit harder to know that, doesn't it? Not necessarily obvious how you would. So, if other bhikkhus should ask that bhikkhu thus, what is the Venerable One's reasons and what is his evidence? Okay? What is his reasons? What is his akara? Okay, it's a very important word, akara. Akara, sometimes meaning like a facet or aspect or cause or it has many different kinds of meanings. Which is why our dictionary says question mark. It's actually a very, very common word. I wonder if we get a better dictionary by clicking that. Probably not. Meaning. Here means reason. Okay.
In other cases.
Ah, can mean anything, like the parts of the body are called akaras? Dvatingsakara? It can be similar to nimitta in the signs by which you know something, the features or properties by which you know something. Many different words. Many different meanings. Care. Anvaya. And anvaya here meaning inference. Okay? And anu, here's this being anu, along with or following. Aya. Go. Okay? So going along. So meaning inference or entailment, induction. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as reasons and evidence. Aya, A-Y-A, E. It's one of the roots to go, E. As in, it's the same, it's a root you find in like Ehi Bhikkhu, Ehi Bhikkhuni. Yeah. Yeah, no, yes, well, this is... This, what are the reasons why you say that the Venerable One is restrained without fear, not by fear, and avoids indulging in sensual pleasures because he is without lust through the destruction of lust? Answering rightly, the Bhikkhu would answer this. Whether that Venerable One dwells in the Sangha or alone, while some there are well-behaved and some are ill-behaved and some there teach a group, meaning, according to the commentary, the opposite of those who teach a group, those who dwell detached from a group, though not mentioned, should be understood. Perhaps. Teaching a group. While some here are seen concerned about material things and some are unsullied by material things, still that Venerable One does not despise anyone because of that. Okay? Okay, so this is one reason that you know. It's quite a good way of inferring, isn't it? Because you see how is a person behaving in different kinds of circumstances, and you know that each one of these things that we do here in the monastery, both living by yourself, okay? So when you're off staying in your kuti alone, you have one way of behavior. And then there's staying in the Sangha, you have another way of behavior. And then there's different kinds of qualities which are tested in different kinds of environments. Yeah? And the same thing when you're among āmisa, so when you have lots of material things or not. And again, that's a way of testing it, isn't it? Like if you, when you have, you know, good food every day, then it's easy to feel comfortable and relaxed and so on. And then when you don't have the good food, then sometimes it's not so easy. And I remember there's one of the many stories from the Thai forest tradition about this, but one of the stories Ajahn Brahm used to tell was about when he was staying in northeastern Thailand and he had this meditation experience, where his mind was very clear and bright and so on, so powerful. He was wondering whether he was enlightened or not. And he came along for the meal time, and at that time they were living in this monastery and there wasn't very much food. And they only had two curries to have with their rice. One was a delicious pork curry and the other one was a revolting, rotten fish, slimy curry. And he was standing there in line, and the monk in front of him thought, it all get mixes up in your stomach anyway, and dumped one pot into the other and mixed them all up. And at that point, his awareness that arose, mindfulness arose, perhaps this is not the end of the path after all. And you know, it's amazing how these things go. You know, you see them and it's just that moment when that thing that you took for granted is not there anymore, yeah? Or sometimes you see it in a different light, like my friend Somjit in Thailand, who bought himself this Harley, and that was really a Harley copy from Japan. It wasn't like a real Harley, but it was still pretty beautiful, and, you know, all shiny and chrome and stuff like that. And he's a silversmith, so he used to carve for himself his own skulls, heads, death skulls out of silver, so to decorate his Harley Davidson with and things like that. And one day something went wrong with it and he had to take it to the garage to get it fixed up, and they took it all apart. You know, and said it just like broke his heart to see his beloved Harley in pieces, and he just realized it's just a motorbike after all, you know. So this is the thing. And Also, the thing about teaching a group is also an interesting one to mention there, because that's also a very powerful, influence on the mind. When you take up a role as a teacher or instructor, then that can very easily change how your mind works. Yeah? So it's something to be very careful about. And so here, this kind of sutta is, I think, focusing very nicely on some of those kinds of defilements and problems which directly affect the Sangha in particular, and are very relevant for those of us who are kind of living this life. And it can be, it can easily be the case. I mean, these things are not such a problem in... Perhaps not such a problem in an Australian context where, we're used to questioning our teachers. Okay, so it's okay if you're at school. I remember when I was in year 11 at school, we started our physics class, and the physics teacher, in the first class, he said, "I want you to understand everything that I say as a question and not as a statement. And so if you want to challenge me on anything, then just feel free to challenge me." And sometimes it did happen that he was challenged on a particular point, and then he would sometimes admit that he was wrong and change his teaching because of that. So that's a very good attitude for a teacher to have. So perhaps not such a problem for us, and more of a problem in traditional societies where it's considered very rude to challenge your teacher. And again, another story about that, when Ajahn Chah went to England. And he was walking around the streets of England. I've probably told this story before, but he was walking around the streets of England, and some sort of yokel comes up to him and sort of shakes his fist under his chin or something like that, and yells some abusive words or something, and he goes off, and all the monks are like really mortified and embarrassed. And Ajahn Chah says, "Wow, I should send all my Ajahns out to England. It's great." So, these things are very, very subtle, The way that they get under your skin is very subtle. Okay. Still, that Venerable One does not despise anyone because of that. Okay. So whatever situation that one's staying in, that one's remains what they call tadi, such. Okay. So you keep that kind of balance where you keep on relying on, well, what is Dhamma, what is Vinaya, what is the appropriate thing in this situation, rather than coming from a place of personal favoritism, likes and dislikes. And I have heard and learnt this from the Blessed One's own lips. I am restrained without fear, not restrained with fear, and I avoid indulging in sensual pleasures because I am without lust through the destruction of lust. Okay? And so this is like a pivot point in the sutta. It then goes on to talk about not just investigating by looking and listening, but also questioning the Tathagata. And regarding all of those things, are there defiled states there? Are there mixed dhammas there? Are there cleaned dhammas there? And in each case, the Tathagata affirms that that's the case. And in the state of cleansed dhammas, it says, "This is they are my pathway and my domain, yet I do not identify with them. Etang patho hamasmi, etang gotara gocharo no chatena dhammayoti." Okay, very beautiful statement there.
Is this a takeoff on the grammatical thing?
Could be, yeah. It's okay. A similar thing, that I am.
This I am, whatever.
Yeah.
Apparently man was made as a...
Yeah, ahamasmi. This is my path.
Halfway, but I do not identify with that.
Exactly, yeah. So exactly. So it's using the same phrase where you're saying you're identifying with everything, but you're saying this is a path, rather than saying it's a thing. Yeah, this is where I live. This is how I live. Etam patohamasmi etam gocharo no chitena tamayo. And tamaya was one of the words which was one of the favorite words of Ajahn Buddhadasa, and at one point, Ajahn Buddhadasa always kept on changing his teachings. One of the great things that he was known for was he would always be very innovative in the way he presented his Dhamma. And at one point he was saying that Atamayata was like the highest Dhamma. It's like beyond emptiness and beyond everything. Atamayata, not made of that, Okay, so tam is that, maya is made of that, like in the first verse of the Dhammapada. Manomaya, made by mind. So tammaya, made of that. Atammaya, not made of that. So not identifying with it. I'm not made of that. Okay. Because a disciple should approach the teacher who speaks thus in order to hear the Dhamma. The teacher teaches in the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. As the teacher teaches the Dhamma to a bhikkhu in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dhamma, the bhikkhu comes to a conclusion about the teachings. Okay, so this is so tasmin dhamme, regarding that Dhamma, abhinyaya, having directly known, idhekachang dhammang, one kind of ekacha, eka meaning one, ekacha meaning a certain one, or one of the. Okay, so one of the Dhammas, in the Dhammas, okay, so lots of Dhammas in this sentence, nityang gacchati, and we've met this phrase before, but literally meaning nitya is conclusion or finish. Okay, so nityang gacchati goes to a conclusion, quite literally the same as the English idiom, one comes to a conclusion. Sattari, again this is a locative, in the sense of about or regarding, but here the locative sattari doesn't look anything like the locatives we've seen before, the tathagata, okay? The normal locative ending is an e, here sattari pasidati. One has faith or is pleased.
Sorry, Avante, is this the Buddha's talking about the Buddha as a teacher or just any teacher?
In this case it would be talking about the Buddha as a teacher, yeah.
I think it may use this. Doesn't this passage appear in another case as well? Has the Buddha as a teacher or someone in the place of the Buddha as your teacher?
Not sure.
Because if he's talking about investigating a teacher and the teacher has to directly experience the Dhamma that they're teaching,
uh-huh.
So the teacher's having the experience of the teaching generally?
Would not have, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they may or may not have. I mean, I think the principle is applicable to anyone. Usually satta, usually in the suttas means the Buddha. Although, of course, it can be used of other teachers as well, but it's usually used of the Buddha. Okay? Okay. Comes to a conclusion about the teachings. Nityangacchati, he has faith. The Buddha is enlightened, samasambuddho bhagava svakkhato, the Dhamma is well explained by the Blessed One, the Sangha is well practiced. So usually that kind of thing, when you have faith in the Triple Gem, usually means that you're stream enterer. Okay. Now, if others should ask that bhikkhu thus, what are the Venerable One's reasons and what is his evidence whereby he says? Okay, so again, the akara, what is the apanayasmato of akara, ke anvaya. And the care being the interrogative particle, the question particle. Why do you say this? The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Answering rightly, that bhikkhu would answer thus. Here, friends, I approached the Blessed One in order to hear the Dhamma. The Blessed One taught me the Dhamma with its higher and higher levels, with its more and more sublime levels, with its dark and bright counterparts. As the Blessed One taught me to the Dhamma in this way, through direct knowledge of a certain teaching here in that Dhamma, I came to a conclusion about the teachings. I placed confidence in the teacher thus. Because whenever ever anyone's faith has been planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata through these reasons, terms, and phrases, his faith is said to be supported by reasons, rooted in vision, firm. It is invincible by any recluse or Brahman or God or Mara or Brahma or by anyone in the world. That is how, because there is an investigation of the Tathagata in accordance with the Dhamma, and that is how the Tathagata is well investigated in accordance with the Dhamma. Okay? So, here, again, obviously implying stream entry, and by these akaras, again, so these reasons, imehi padehi, pada is a word, literal meaning is foot, but often meaning word. Vyanjanehi, phrases or illustrations or something. these are phrases. Tathagata saddha nivitta hoti. So the faith is planted or established or something like that. Nivitta hoti mula jata. Okay. Deeply rooted. Okay. Rooted patipita and firmly established. Okay. And then this is called bhikkhus akaravati saddha dasana mulika. So this is a very important phrase, and especially this thing of akaravati saddha, reasoned faith. Okay, so we've seen that akara through this sutra is used in the sense of reasoned. Okay, so reasoned faith, akaravati saddha, is the term for the faith of the stream enterer, dasana mulika, rooted in vision. Okay, so the stream enterer has had a vision of the dhamma, and this particular kind of faith has been particularly emphasized by Jayati Lekha in his Buddhist, what is it called? The Buddhist, early Buddhist theory of knowledge. Yeah. And of course, contrasting with the andha sadha, the blind faith. So, it's quite nice, isn't it? And it is firm, dalha, okay? And unshakable. Invincible, sangharya, by anyone in the world. Okay, so the idea, this practice of investigation of the Tathagata starts out with just watching, listening, investigating, inquiring, not necessarily just believing everything, not just believing that, you know, because he's got a reputation of being enlightened or something like that, that therefore he must be, but really testing him out as best you can. And if you get the opportunity to actually inquire, you can ask, do you have defiled states? And then see what he has. Of course, if one does have defiled states, he might lie. So it's not a perfect solution, but it's one way of learning. But then, of course, the best way of learning is through practicing the Dhamma that the Buddha taught. When you've done that, then finally, if you see the same Dhamma that the Buddha saw, then you know that what he's teaching must be true. So this is how the Buddha, I believe, as far as I'm aware, is Buddhism the only religion in the world where the teacher actually not merely encouraged investigation, but actually gave a series of quite difficult tests and inquiries on how he should be investigated? Is there any other religion in the world where this occurs?
It's kind of something a bit unique, is that it's kind of a fusion of the teachings and the teacher. Like you're investigating the teaching to investigate the teacher and the vice versa.
Yeah, because he's the embodiment of the teachings. He's not just like a professor of Buddhism who, you know, stands up and tells you what everything is.
Isn't the Buddha said that he has no fear of people going for that analysis, isn't it? No fear of anything in the world.
Yeah. How would Mara want to teach us? If Mara was saying you should investigate me, how would he say you should investigate me?
Investigate Mara.
By how shiny his new car is.
Yeah.
By using your perception to investigate. Mundane perception.
Wouldn't you just do the same thing?
Mara?
Yeah, like in some subtle
shifts. That's not really Mara's kind of star, is it? Well, he's a bit. He wants to trick you.
By convincing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But just like.
He'd give a spin, you think?
By convincing us of countries that have mass weapons of mass destruction when they don't.
Yeah. Well, what's even more of that is convincing yourself, people that other people, countries have weapons of mass destruction when your country is actually capable of blowing up the entire planet about 50 times over. And you think having a few bombs is a weapon of mass destruction? Oh, yeah.
You have to be afraid of Iran who's going to start World War III.
Yeah, right.
Didn't even know anything. Exactly.
And you're the only country that's ever used bombs. Anyway. Yeah. So, that's that. Vimaksika Sutta. Any more questions on that? We might move on to the Kausambhya Sutta if there's no objections or any more questions.
Did you give
for example, for dark and bright counterparts, what do you mean?
Ah, just good dhammas and bad dhammas. Yeah? So when it says here the counterparts, kanha sukha pati bhagang, that's just that's what that refers to is like the Buddha's way of teaching where you can where a good thing will have its counterpart in the bad thing. Okay? So for example, Buddha talking about say the five hindrances. Okay, so he teaches five hindrances. And you know, these are like the dark side. Yeah, so if you've got the mind with the five hindrances, and then he'd say, well, you overcome those five hindrances with the seven enlightenment factors. Yeah, and so this is the bright side. Yeah, so this is that teaching.
And then why is it something like a stream and entry and entrance for those who investigate the Buddha?
Okay. In the suttas, there's various ways of mentioning things like stream entry and arahantship and so on, where it doesn't always explicitly say someone's a stream enterer, someone's a sotapanna. Okay, that's just one way of expressing it. Okay, now in this particular sutta, it says, what does it say here?
Faith. Was it reason faith?
Reason faith. Yeah. Now the first one. I came to a conclusion about the teaching. Yeah, when it says here that the Blessed One taught me the Dhamma, the more high and sublime Dhammas with its dark and its bright side, as he was teaching me, and so on, and then that Dhamma, Abhinyaya. Okay, so this word Abhinyaya means like a direct or realization of the teachings. Okay, it doesn't mean just an intellectual understanding, but it means a direct knowledge of it. Okay, so the word abhinya usually is used of either stream entry or one of the higher stages, or it's used of like the psychic powers, also called abhinyas. Okay, so it means some kind of directly knowing something. So that's one clue. It says by directly knowing those dhammas, then I had the faith in the teacher. Okay, so normally faith is also a quality that's very strongly associated with the stream enterer. So when he says he has faith in the triple gem, and that faith is because of directly knowing the Dhamma, then we can, sounds pretty much like they're a stream enterer, okay, already. But then when we look at the next paragraph, and it says that their faith is nivitta, mulajata patipita, and unshakable, founded, deeply rooted faith, rooted in vision, dasana mulika, and completely unshakable by anyone, then we know for sure that it must be a stream enterer. Yeah? And that's again one of the great qualities of a stream enterer, is their unshakable faith.
Maybe that refers to the path and fruition. Once you attain the path, you have faith, and then when the fruition of the experience of the Dhamma comes through, then you have unshakable faith.
I'm not sure that it's making that kind of distinction here. Yeah.
Because otherwise it seems a little bit verbose.
No, it's just a way of talking, that's all. In fact, it probably isn't, because with this one, Abhinyaya, actually the one on the path to stream entry, it specifically says that they don't directly see the Dhamma. So the one on the path is one who, what does it say? The Nijhana Kanti, he has the reflective acceptance of the Dhamma. Yeah? Rather than direct seeing of the Dhamma. But here it's saying has the direct seeing. These things are quite precisely used. Words like abhinya is quite precisely used.
It's not an inferential term.
It's not an inferential term. That's direct knowledge, yeah.
This reminds me of the Ratana Sutta verse.
Yantindakila, padawing sitosia, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so that idea of being unshakable by any of the winds, yeah. And of course this idea of the unshakable pillar being quite important in India, and they would when they put the Ashoka pillars up, and they typically would put them like half underground and half above the ground. It's kind of massive pillars, and dig them halfway down, and so they really were just about unshakable. And some of them even lasted from the time of Ashoka to the present day. In fact, a couple of them were broken and so on. The only one which still stands in whole is the one in Vaisali. And Venerable Dhammananda Bhikkhuni suggested that was because that was where the Bhikkhuni order was established. So that's managed to sustain that one pretty high. No, these are just pillars. Yeah, they're about like this big, solid rock. How high is the Ashoka pillars? High. The one in Vesali, how big is it? I've only been there once at night time.
The one in Lumbini is about...
But that's broken off. Yeah, the one in Vesali is... I'll see if I get a picture of it.
And they go about halfway under something.
Yeah. Yeah. Bodh Gaya. Yeah, no, there is one in Bodh Gaya. That's the one that the novices used to throw coins on top.
Yeah, the Indians throw a show of coin on the top.
Yeah, they've now stopped doing that because of...
Something.
Well, good luck. Randitya, Valavana. Notice the gum trees. Not these should be renamed, not the bamboo grove, but the gum tree grove. The vulture's peak, looking suitably rugged. Sala, see, the different kind of vibe, you get this different vibe from the Vulture's Peak, is really kind of rugged and, you know, rough and out there, and very kind of exotic. And Savatthi is very gentle. Okay, so it's kind of very, kind of softly undulating ground. And most of these buildings were kind of built about maybe 9th century or something like that. A beautiful place for sitting meditation in Savatthi. And Dirwana. And here's Lichavi, here's the stupa, and the Ashokan pillar. Again, it doesn't have the height of it, but you can see it's pretty high. Maybe 20 meters or something? Yeah, something like that. And so, you know, again, it's lasted for well over 2,000 years.
And so what do they represent again?
Well, many different kinds of things you could take them to represent, but it's like a mark of... One thing is a mark of firmness, you know, so that's how it's used as a metaphor. It's something that's unshakable. And so it's a sign, for Ashoka was a sign of his dominion. You know, the lion was the other ways, it's like the four animals in other ones, it's like the lion, the elephant, the cow, and the horse, and four noble beasts. So, I mean, apart from anything else, incredible works of art, and they're still shiny is one of the things that's amazing about them. They've still got their gloss on them. They're polished, they've got incredible gloss. One of the other amazing things about them is that there's precisely nothing in ancient India before that. Before that was only the Indus Valley civilization, which was 1,000 years previously, so there's no obvious connection between the two. Then there's almost 1,000 years of virtual gap in the archaeological record. And then they come up with these things. And there's not a single item of stone carving in ancient India that predates this. The Indus Valley stuff is all clay carving. And they come up with this thing which is this magnificent artworks. And they were quarried near Benares. There's a quarry there.
You're saying that for 1,000 years before Buddha there was no art?
From Ashoka, which is like 150 years after the Buddha, for 1,000 years before that, there's no archaeological anything, basically. No statues, no inscriptions, no buildings, almost nothing. Yeah, it's all later. Yeah, it's all later than that. Yeah. The only stuff which is earlier is the Indus Valley stuff, which is again like, maybe 1,000 years or so earlier. Yeah, it is. It's very remarkable why there isn't anything. Part of it was because the architecture was wood, even the monumental architecture was wood in that time, so a lot of it's disappeared.